There's a widespread myth that Roe v. Wade is settled and entitled to respect as judicial precedent. The purveyors of this myth must ignore the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions going back to the earliest days of the court, which point to judicial criticism and legal scholarly criticism as keeping prior decisions unsettled. Most importantly, the purveyors of the myth that Roe is settled and entitled to respect as judicial precedent must ignore four decades of detailed, comprehensive, and specific judicial and scholarly criticism of Roe itself. And in fact, because Roe is radically unsettled, long-standing principles of precedent dictate that it must be reconsidered. These words are those of Clark Forsythe, senior counsel at Americans United for Life, and author of AUL's A Survey of Judicial and Scholarly Criticism of Roe v. Wade since 1973. We speak with Clark today about his new and important survey of judicial and scholarly criticism of Roe and what lessons that advocates and lawmakers can take away from the past half century of popular constitutional criticism of Roe and abortion culture. I am Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law from Americans United for Life, where we advance the human right to life in culture, law, and policy. I am Tom Shakley, and we're thrilled to be joined today by Clark Forsythe, senior counsel at Americans United for Life. Clark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Clark, it is so amazing going through, you know, we know that you put out so much great content. You've written two powerful books, which we've spoken about previously on Life, Liberty, and Law, but you've just put out, as if it's nothing, as if it's no work at all, you're not even breaking a sweat, a new 50-page comprehensive white paper on Roe, on its structural problems, its constitutional problems, its common sense problems. Clark, what led you to write this?
There's this myth that Roe is settled and all this data and 50 years of writings show it's not. As I read many of these over the years, I just got to be impressed by the amount of criticism of Roe. In addition, not too many people know about it. They think Roe's settled. They have no idea all of this has accumulated. And it raises just questions about, questions about the Supreme Court and precedent. Just because five justices decide something, is it the law, and does it always have to be the law? So all these questions have come together with the Dobbs decision, and it was finally time to get this out to inform people.
Yeah. So, of course, Dobbs is looming large on the horizon, the Mississippi case concerning abortion at 15 weeks, these protections that Mississippi is trying to put in place and what the court may or may not do with Mississippi and with Roe v. Wade itself. But, you know, in the more immediate term, Clark, let's dig into this idea of being settled versus unsettled, because I think you're exactly right. What you mentioned, you know, when I hear, you know, in the newspapers or in the media that the Supreme Court has ruled in a particular decision, and now that ruling, it's the law of the land, right? Well, does that mean it's settled or is it unsettled? Is it settled just because the Supreme Court hands down a decision? And if not, what makes it unsettled?
Well, the court has for a long time considered judicial criticism either inside the court or judicial criticism from lower court judges as keeping a legal question or a decision unsettled. And then for a long time, it's also looked at what the legal profession had thought, what practicing lawyers, what legal organizations, and finally what legal academics think about a particular decision. So the courts long considered this as important, but again, there's this modern bias that none of that matters. If five justices decided something, it's the law. It's always got to be the law, and you just have to respect it. And And that's that modern prejudice is really at odds with the way the court thought for the first 150 years.
This is kind of bringing me back to that old saying from the Greek Civil War days, right? It's like the strong will do what they will and the weak will suffer what they must. But you're kind of saying like that it's not the case, actually, that, you know, mom or dad, for instance, can say, we're going to Denny's. But the family, the people, so to speak, can rebel. They could say, no, we're going to Outback. And to some extent, that has to be mediated, right?
I just wish that the questions were always that simple or mundane. So many people just are buying into this modern prejudice. I mean, for example, the whole question, well, if five justices decided, then it's the law. The traditional notion was exactly the opposite. Well, if five justices decided something, that means four didn't or four dissented on a 9-person court. And therefore, the court's divided. So, if five have just decided something, you have a divided court, and the question's unsettled. All of this is the traditional way the court thought of things. But modern judges, legal scholars who are pro-abortion advocates. Just want to ignore all this history, and just keep emphasizing that this has been decided. It's got to stay this way. And you're going to hear this. You're going to hear this in May and June when the Dobbs decision comes out. Whether the court cuts back on Roe or overturns it, you're going to hear this. And people need to understand that this is just contrary to the way we've traditionally thought of things.
Yeah, I think, too, in terms of the court trying to operate outside of politics, trying to focus on the Constitution, trying to focus on the legal and cultural problems of this issue, but, you know, also dealing with those political realities, right, that, you know, we remember back at the June Medical Services rally that Americans United for Life was proudly outside the Supreme Court for, where Catherine Glenn Foster, our president, spoke just before the pandemic, and then more recently the Dobbs rally. But at the JMS rally, I'm thinking of in particular, it was, Senate Minority Leader at the time, Chuck Schumer, who issued what was received as an open threat to the court, you know, warning specific justices of the court to vote the way he wanted them to vote politically on the issue. And John Roberts, I mean, really a rare, maybe not unprecedented, but very rare rebuke, public rebuke, kind of asserting the independence of the judiciary against this incursion, attempted incursion from the Senate. And so they're weighing this as well, right? That they have to make a decision that's sound, that has the hope of being settled, but also that isn't purely partisan or political, right?
Well, that's what we hope. Back in 1992 in Casey, through a plurality of three justices said, the country has to follow what the court has found to be grounded in the Constitution. But they never explained how the abortion right is grounded in the Constitution. They've never explained that. It just shows that the court has been lawless in keeping to this decision that has been so widely criticized, and that the court can't even justify. It imposes it on the nation without giving a rational justification for why it's constitutional law, which, of course, we know it did.
So we're going to
know it isn't.
We're going to move through your piece more in a moment. But before we do, say there was a 9-0 decision, right? Could that be unsettled by the same method you're saying of just continued kind of scholarly legal criticism, pushback, refutation?
Well, that's hard to imagine. I mean, unless it didn't deal with constitutional interpretation and it dealt with, some drug policy that, could be changed by Congress or something. But go back to Brown v. Board of Education. Why did Chief Justice Earl Warren work for months to get a unanimous court? Because he knew that in a controversial decision like overturning separate but equal, overturning Plessis versus Ferguson, that it would be a powerful statement to the country if it was 9-0. And it has been. No one, that is settled. No one questions Brown v. Board of Education.
Right.
And in large part because it was 9-0. If it had come out 5-4 with four strong dissents, who knows what the last, 40, 50 years would have been like.
Yeah.
But thankfully, with his Warren's leadership on that particular issue, and in that particular case, the court settled the issue.
So, Clark, in your piece, you write, and I'm going to quote here just this paragraph, Roe created at least three constitutional conflicts. Congress's debate over pro-life constitutional amendments between 1973 and 83, the dispute between Congress and the court over abortion funding that induced the court to retreat a few years after Roe in the case of Harris v. McRae, and the ongoing 48-year tension between the court and a growing number of states that are determined to protect human life, unquote. I thought that was important, this inclusion of this, to show that, this isn't just a dry academic kind of ivory tower debate, but to show quite directly how a judicial opinion or a constitutional issue can have these rippling long-term effects in politics and society, right? And so in that sense, the court is outside to some degree of political or partisan concerns, but it has the capacity, for better or worse, to shape them profoundly, right?
Shape these constitutional conflicts that go to the very core of the Constitution, but that those conflicts also show that this isn't as the media, some in the media would like to, kind of describe it as just dissenting pro-lifers or a bunch of loonies arguing about Roe. No, judges, justices, and scholars, major scholars, have recognized for a long time that Roe created these three constitutional conflicts. In one case, in the case of all those constitutional amendments that were introduced in Congress between 73 and 83, there was a real constitutional crisis going on.
And this is the issue today, I think, that it seems as if the court's in between a rock and a hard place, right? Where sort of, pro-lifers on the one side are really, I think, earnestly and rightfully expecting that Roe will be reversed in Dobbs. That's certainly the hope. And those who are pro-abortion and pro-status quo want exactly the opposite. And it's like, where is the room for a decision that has the capacity to lower the temperature on this debate? I think what you've done in highlighting this half century of scholarly and judicial criticism is to sort of show how experts, how judges, how justices and others have been commenting on this and maybe pointing ways out of it, out of this bind of increasing the temperature forever, right?
Yes, and the I think the justices already are familiar with much of what's in this publication on judicial and scholarly criticism. They're aware of many of these criticisms, but many outside the legal profession are not, and it needed to be compiled. Just the amount of it is just impressive, and pro-lifers are opposed to Roe versus Wade because Roe versus Wade legalized nationwide the killing of babies. But there have got to be more arguments than that. The when you work in the legal profession, you mount as many arguments in favor of your case as you can. Americans need to know that there is not just one reason why Roe is a bad decision. There are dozens of reasons. And this criticism by judges, justices, and by legal academics and scholars over the years have put together what is increasingly an impressive array of criticisms of what the court has done. And I'm convinced that we'll see some of this cited in the opinions that come out in the Dobbs case.
Yeah. I recently saw a tweet from, I forget whether it was NARAL or a different pro-abortion corporation, but in any event, they're all kind of the same. And the tweet was something to the effect of, the issue of voting rights is fundamental to reproductive justice, and of course this is just a marketing thing that they're putting out there, but my first thought is if a so-called fundamental right of abortion is dependent upon a continued Democratic vote for it, then where did the constitutional argument go? why is that being jettisoned now of all times? But of course, I think they're saying that through the prism of saying, you know, well, the president who's voted in gets to appoint the Supreme Court justices, and, you know, they want to have people who are ideologically pliant to continue to uphold Roe, Casey, et cetera. But abortion has distorted the law and culture since its inception, and you address that as well.
Absolutely. It has abortion has distorted so much. Roe versus Wade has distorted so much. How the justices go about interpreting the Constitution, among many other doctrines. It's distorted the First Amendment because the judges have said, well, we're going to twist the First Amendment so that no pro-lifers can be outside an abortion clinic. Or we're going to twist doctrine of who can go into court so that the abortion right is protected. And there have just been so many ways. And in fact, the irony is that Roe has corrupted, distorted how judges talk about precedent, because traditionally judges were willing to reconsider precedent. But the modern view is, oh, no, we must never reconsider precedent because that could end up overturning Roe if we reconsider precedent. So Roe's distortive effect has just been vast, and that's one of the reasons why the court has to throw it out, so that it stops distorting so much of our law and politics.
And it's hard in a certain sense because, you know, as the country becomes, you know, more powerful, especially, you know, I'm thinking in the kind of the sweep of American history, particularly post-World War II, but even to the present. You know, as the Supreme Court itself has become more vaunted in a certain sense at the heart of so many cultural issues, deciding things that I think in previous generations people would have looked to Congress for in terms of a constitutional amendment, or would have looked to their state houses for in terms of, or their governors in terms of action on the state level. Today, you know, everyone is sort of looking to the Supreme Court to decide these things. And I think, you know, when we look at something like a judicial confirmation hearing, for the Supreme Court, whatever your views are, you know it's going to just be an absolute mess. And it's not good for the country. It's just not good for the country for people to go up, whether you're Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor or Amy Coney Barrett or Clarence Thomas or whomever, for there to be, you know, it's like if there's the news of a Supreme Court retirement or a death, the whole country should not be sort of, you know, gripping the sides of the table, just sort of gritting their teeth to say, oh my gosh, how long is this going to take? You know, it's not good for us.
It isn't. It's not for the good for the court. It's not good for future justices that even if they're confirmed, they've been the target of this campaign of personal destruction that's going to stay with them throughout the time that they're on the court. But, you know, the consideration of Supreme Court justices should involve more than the abortion issue. The justices have an impact on so many other issues in American life in interpreting the Constitution, such as you mentioned, who should decide these some questions. Should it be the states? Should it be Congress? Should it be the Supreme Court? And we don't get into those questions, and they're sidelined because abortion advocates make abortion the most important issue. That's another example of how Roe has just distorted our law and politics.
You quote Clark at one point from Marianne Glendon's great book, 1994 book called A Nation of Lawyers, where Glendon writes that the plurality in Casey, the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, claimed for the court a more exalted role than any to which the original judicial activist, John Marshall, had aspired in his boldest moments. Glendon writes, Marshall never proposed, as did Justices Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor, and David Souter, that the court's powers should include telling the country what its quote-unquote constitutional ideals should be. Nor can one imagine Marshall, Glendon writes, proclaiming that the American people would be quote-unquote tested by following the court's leadership. And as you already mentioned, Clark, of course, the Casey attempt to sort of say, well, you know, it's been an interesting 20 years since Roe, and but here's the decision, and, you know, let's get back to daily life. That didn't work. And it seems to me that what Glendon was hinting at in her book that came out right after that Casey decision, and what you're getting at in your piece now that's out, this great white paper, is that, you know, the court, to successfully resolve the issue of abortion, is going to require, I think, at least two virtues, but these are maybe the two principal virtues: courage and humility, right? Clark, you've written about the importance of prudence, but it seems like humility in particular, I mean, courage to face the issue directly, to not try to obfuscate, to not try to say, well, let's consider a sort of more narrow procedural issues or whatever, and kind of not touch abortion as if it's going to go away, and humility to not continue to try to put themselves at the center of the whole thing, right? To, you know, as you've talked about the National Abortion Control Board, that this is how the Supreme Court is sort of acting. Well, it's going to require humility to step back.
Absolutely. You're spot on. And it's great you bring those virtues up. We can only hope and pray they have courage. Unfortunately, the plurality in Casey in 92 didn't have courage and have, as a result, put the country through, 27 more years, at least, of this maelstrom. And then humility, that they rightly know their place and the court's place and what it isn't in American society. And Glendon's, I'm so glad you emphasized Glendon, because she's written a number of just brilliant, important books. And her criticism of Roe in her 1987 book, Abortion and Divorce in Western Law, and then her criticism of Casey in the 94 book were so important, because she's just one of the most impressive scholars in the United States, and I'm glad she criticized those decisions as she did. I think a number of justices on the court respect her, and may end up citing her in the Dobbs decision.
Well, Clark, I'm so glad again that you wrote this piece, and I'm glad that it's out there. You know, I'm curious, you know, what do you hope now that it's available, and we're going to link to it, of course, in the notes for this show. It's on AUL.org. We're going to send a direct link so you can get the full PDF. But Clark, when you sat down to write this, I guess the first question I have is, why did something like this already exist in such a compact and accessible form? And the second question is, you know, what do you hope that advocates, you know, on the grassroots level in the states and at the federal level, and lawmakers will do with it? How do you hope it will inform their work?
Well, I hope it will inform legislators and the bills they introduce and the support they give to bills protecting life in the states. I hope it will inform judges, depending on what the court does with Dobbs and whether it just pairs back on Roe or overturns it. But also, I really wanted to educate young lawyers and law students who aren't going to hear about these criticisms of Roe in law school unless they find this. I just think people need to be impressed by the fact that this criticism has grown decade by decade. And although, you know, it's heartbreaking that we're still at this 48 years later in opposing Roe, yet there's this mountain of criticism that has grown. And I'm just grateful that these people have written these criticisms over the years and published them.
Well, Clark, I think it's safe to say that neither you nor I, nor Americans United for Life, expects there to be a small decision. We don't expect the court to punt wholly in the Dobbs case. It's going to be a consequential decision regardless of its outcome. We do hope that Roe is reversed and that the issue of justice can reign on abortion and guide America's heart. But let's imagine for a moment, Clark, that the court fails in its duty, in its call to have courage and humility, and either avoids the issue directly, makes it too narrow, or continues to put itself at the center of the issue. Sort of say, you know, well, here's our decision. We're going to continue to deal with this for the time to come. I mean, what does that mean for the pro-life movement? What does it mean for those who are pro-abortion? Does this extend it for another generation? What are the possible outcomes if they're not favorable as we expect?
Well, I think the reaction of the pro-life movement to the Casey decision in '92 was basically, we kind of spent a day analyzing and criticizing, and then got up the next morning and went back to work. And frankly, I think that is got to be the same reaction to Dobbs if it is a very disappointing decision, because just objectively, Roe is wrong, and objectively, the court can't make it work, and objectively, there are all these reasons why Roe and Casey are wrong and unworkable and have created such a distortion of American law and politics. And even if a majority of justices can't simply settle it, they cannot do it. And I'm convinced after the arguments on December 1 in the Dobbs case in the Supreme Court that a majority understand that they can't settle it. I think the question in my mind is, do they do it in Dobbs or do they do it in a case or two after Dobbs? We hope they'll do it in Dobbs, but I'm convinced that a majority will do it at some point.
Yeah. I mean, when I reflect, Clark, the March for Life has just taken place last week. And, we're coming out of a January and the start of a new year where, every January we celebrate Martin Luther King Day. And we reflect on the power of impressive, justice-oriented, nonviolent advocacy for what's right and for what's good. And I think, of how amazing it is. Clark, you and I have both been to the beautiful new MLK Monument in Washington, D.C. We were there together a few years ago. And, when I'm there, I have a lot of hope because I think, on the darker part of our nation's story, a half century or so ago, when, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was one of the U.S. organs working against Martin Luther King, right? Working against, so many of his peers who were fighting for civil rights. It was the FBI, from the scholarly work I've read, did a lot of negative and questionable things concerning MLK, from spying on him to much worse. And yet, now a few decades later, our nation honors him and honors his legacy with a monument, right, in one of the nation's most hallowed grounds in the capital city of the country. And so when I see something like that, I become much more hopeful about the issue to actually successfully resolve the injustice of abortion.
I agree. Every time the Martin Luther King holiday comes around, I spend time reflecting and reading about Dr. King and the movement and those who worked with him because they are inspiring examples. And they suffered a lot to overturn separate but equal and to bolster civil rights and grow civil rights for Black Americans. And it's completely inspiring for what we do. And I reflect upon them a lot. They're great, great heroes, great examples.
Well, Clark, your piece, again, A Survey of Judicial and Scholarly Criticism of Roe v. Wade Since 1973, link to it in the show notes. It's on AUL.org. Clark, something we do every show is our shot of gratitude. So what's something you're grateful for these days?
Well, there's a lot. 2021 was a very consequential year. I'm grateful for the progressive change in the Supreme Court, and I'm grateful for all these judges and scholars who have mounted this criticism that I think will finally bring down Roe versus Wade. It's a great time to be involved in this work.
Yeah, agreed wholeheartedly. I'm grateful for our continuing impact. We've talked many times on the show here that this is Americans United for Life's 50th anniversary, celebrating 50 years of impact and really looking ahead to the future. Our work started, with Roe and with the issue of abortion, but it's expanded across the bioethical spectrum. And, in that sense, this is a mission for every age and season in American life. And it's just such an honor to be here working alongside you, Clark, and building Americans United for Life for the next generation.
Amen, Tom. It's good to talk with you today. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thanks so much, Clark. Take care.
God bless.
All right, if you enjoyed our conversation with Clark Forsyth, Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to Life, Liberty, and Law. Rate the show and leave a review. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for Clark Forsyth or for me, just email us at life@aul.org. And if you're still listening, visit aul.org/give and become a monthly donor. All the work that we do is because of donors of all ages, backgrounds, and beliefs across the country and across the world. Support from across America is vital to the work we do. We're not funded by taxpayer dollars like Planned Parenthood or other big abortion businesses. We're supported by the grassroots American people. So thanks for your support. And if you haven't given yet or haven't given recently, please visit AUL.org today. Learn about our recent impact and renew your support. I am Tom Shakley, and until next time, thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.